Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of April 2nd, 2015. Today we're joined by our frequent guest and co-host, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing today, D.R.?
Good, how are you doing?
Good. I'm glad you're here. So, D.R., we may be doing okay, but in the South Pacific, there was a horrific hurricane, Hurricane Pamela, in fact, that basically destroyed the society on an island in the South Pacific, right?
Yes.
What happened?
This was the Cyclone Pam, which hits the tropical island of Vanuatu earlier this month, and it was just. At least 24 people from the last report I saw have perished. I assume it's inevitably going to be more. There's billions of dollars in damage. You look at the photos. The photos look like, looks like literally ground zero in this country. 9/11, and was one of the strongest. If I believe it may be the second strongest, or possibly in fact the strongest recorded storm on record, and just left you know unspeakable amounts of damage, and it is considered a Category 5 cyclone. And just an example, once again, just like Typhoon Haiyan, of the destructive power of a warming planet, as President Obama put it.
And I guess right, I mean there's several examples floating around right now, some more personal and connected to us than others, but this ferocious hurricane in the South Pacific, no one's surprised, no climate scientist is shocked. This is completely consistent with the kind of intense storms that we think may the future will hold. It has wreaked havoc on this tiny little defenseless nation in the South Pacific, and everyone yawns. No surprise, since we here in the mainland United States aren't particularly affected, no one seems to particularly care. Of course, we extend our deepest condolences. There are people here in the U.S. who care and extend their sympathy to the people on the island. But generally speaking, it doesn't register very well. Here in New England, we have had the snowiest winter on record. If you're a climate denier, that's just proof that climate change does not exist. But in fact, the high snow levels here are also consistent with climate change. In fact, this winter was quite a warm winter in the Southwest and in Alaska. All the cold and snow that we got here in the Northeast of the United States was mirrored by extremely warm weather in Alaska and on the West Coast. They couldn't have the famous Iditarod dog sled race because there was not enough snow around up in Alaska. We were getting it. So then, late this past week, there's yet another sort of telling message coming from an analysis of the following thing. People have often heard of the Gulf Stream. Right. The Gulf Stream is essentially a river of warm water that flows up from the tropics. It goes up the east coast of the United States, takes a big turn up around Greenland, goes down by England, and then continues on. But by that time, it's lost a lot of heat. The Gulf Stream gives up a lot of heat to the northeast, and it's what makes England so warm. I mean, if you look at a global map, I think London is about the same latitude as Saskatchewan or something. I mean, it's way north, but it's kept warm by the Gulf Stream. Well, the reason the Gulf Stream works is because of the salinity, the saltiness of the water. And if that salty water, when it cools off, tends to be heavy and it sinks into the ocean, and that's essentially the engine that drives it. You have this sinking salty water up around Greenland. Fine, fine. Except when the ice in Greenland starts to melt, it makes that water less salty because you're adding all this fresh water. It doesn't sink as fast. So this heavy, salty water that's not as salty, it doesn't sink the same way. The Gulf Stream flow is interrupted. And there are hints that, so there you go. And climate scientists have been worried for a long time that the Gulf Stream may be slowing down, may not bring as much warmth to the north of the United States, and that over the course of a century or two, the Gulf Stream might collapse. This latest report says it's more precarious than we thought. There's more salt water. And in fact, one of the few places in the world that was colder this winter was over the North Atlantic, primarily because the Gulf Stream wasn't bringing up quite as much heat. And there's every chance that that slowing of the Gulf Stream is connected to the kind of weather we've been seeing here in Boston. It is a not a very happy prospect, and one that DR, I think, Hollywood got to first, right?
Exactly. An extreme version of what's going on was
And
depicted
let
in
me
the
just
film.
say, you said extreme, and let me, it's extremely, extremely extreme, the movie you're going to talk about, all right? It's not just extreme, it's really extreme.
A hyper extreme version of what was depicted was shown in the film The Day After Tomorrow. And Stefan Rahmstorf, who prepared this report, who co-wrote this report with, I believe, Michael Mann and a couple of other climate scientists, noted in realclimate.org earlier this week, quote, "The consequences of a large reduction in ocean overturning would look nothing like the Hollywood film The Day After Tomorrow, but they would not be harmless either. For example, for sea level, particularly along the U.S. East Coast, marine ecosystems, fisheries, and probably even storminess in Europe. If our analysis is correct, then this indicates that climate models underestimate the weakening of the Atlantic circulation in response to global warming, probably because the flow in these models is too stable. And if the circulation weakens too much, it can even completely break down, and this would be considered one of the tipping points that Jim Hansen talks about, where you hit a level of irreversible global warming and basically, let's be honest here, mass death afterwards.
Right. Well, I think that if the Gulf Stream were to slow down over, well, it's a tipping point, but I mean a geological tipping point over some decades, you would tend to get much colder weather in New England and in Northern Europe, in Europe, than you're getting now. I guess the so here you go. You get all these things. You got a horrific hurricane in the South Pacific. You have this clear signal of climate change here in the Northeast, and we all remain in the communal and consensual trance, right? We all, as Bill McKibben said, as long as you don't say climate change, you're safe. You can go about your daily living. But once you say climate change, you have to freak out because it is so weird. And my question for you, DR, is how come these kinds of news stories don't register more? Why are people not and I ask that question not to condemn those people, but somehow, how is it that we climate hawks can somehow make progress to make the connection in people's heads between these, weird and unusual weather events, and the obvious pattern that global warming would bring? Let me
It
put that one in your lap, huh? Yeah, that's an easy one to answer.
brings up a great story that was report that appeared earlier this week in the LA Times, by Michael Hitzlick, discussing how elected officials sometimes get away with lying, basically, about climate change and how they're not called to account by major media entities, which are afraid for various reasons of violating the tenets of false balance, afraid of essentially being falsely accused of bias, afraid of, again, in an extreme example, reporters being nervous about having to work with entities that become known for promoting false balance, and as a result, there's a sort of code of silence, a climerta, if you will, that prevents major news organizations from discussing this issue and giving it the coverage it deserves and that it needs. The former Boston Globe reporter Ross Gilpspan, who went on to write the books The Heat Is On and Boiling Point, has said that the media's cowardice on this issue over the course of the past 25 years is a major, major driver of the climate crisis. The fact that it is underreported, badly reported, and the fact that false balances allowed free rein in so many major media entities. And Joe Rome, among others, has pointed out that we need reporters like Edward R. Murrow. We need reporters to tell this story without fear or favor, and to basically get it on the record that this is what is happening. And so long as you have this culture of cowardice and this fear of running afoul of powerful elected officials and powerful polluting interests, so long as that's the case, then the press will then the public will remain disinformed, misinformed, and largely ignorant of the threat that we're facing.
I agree. I mean, I think another way to put it is that the media needs to establish and allow some kind of trusted voice to speak truth about this and not run away from the climate issue. I mean, I think one of the articles that we both talked about basically posed the question of, if a presidential candidate denied the germ theory, excuse me, or said that gravity is not doesn't work, didn't believe in gravity, he would be called out. And there are certain presidential candidates who should remain nameless that just get to say scientifically untrue things, and everyone smiles. And I guess the it's a sign of the times that these guys can get away with saying things that are patently false and not be challenged.
The idea of people being allowed to cruise along and getting away with lies about science is just it's appalling. And again, it leads to this culture where people will hear lies and think those lies are true, and that is dangerous in any society for any issue where a certain percentage of the public is allowed to buy into the notion that false reality is reality, which is why whenever the media allows false reality and lies to be published and to be promoted without refutation, it does a disservice to democracy. It does
I mean,
it betrays the tenets of journalism, and it betrays their own positions. And really, it is time to grow a set, as they say, and report this story accurately.
I guess it's almost worse in the sense, well, the way I would put it is that when a candidate says something that is patently false, and you know it's false, and he knows it's false, but we all accept it, that is corrosive. To, I mean, and we all say, "Oh yeah, well, they're just." I mean, it's a bad case. And I guess the take-home lesson that I take out of this is that it's the climate hawks' responsibility to demand that kind of accountability from the news media. I mean, every one of us can write a letter to the editor, can go on the comment stream on some a TV channel or whatever, and demand that people speak sensibly about these things. And other than that, yeah, I mean, as you say, it's a code of silence. If nobody says the emperor has no clothes, then we all pretend he's fully robed, right? Until somebody starts to consistently point out that many public officials do not speak accurately about science. So that brings me to another article that actually DRU sent, which is really a nice one. It's by a woman named Rebecca Solnit, which I think we've mentioned her before. She basically makes the case in a beautifully written article that we cannot know the future. The future is not a linear extrapolation of the past, and that as a climate hawk, you sit and look. If you linearly extrapolate the past into the future, you say, "Okay, David Koch's going to rule the world. The fossil fuel companies are going to own everything, and that's where we're going, and that's the future." But she points out quite rightly that the future is uncharted territory, often holds surprises, and often, not often, but almost always responds to the activities of people who try and create the future and do so in funny ways. And of course, marriage equality and civil rights, all kinds of things come up as being unimaginable circumstances that were changed because people cared about it. And that her idea is that the the most important thing that climate hawks can do about global warming is to try to do something about it. And it's almost irrelevant exactly what you're trying to do, but trying to do something adds into that unpredictable mix. I mean, she at one point she was talking about the Freedom Riders in 1964. And if they are judged simply on whether or not in September of 1964 they'd succeeded in their original goal, well, maybe they did and maybe they didn't. But they had an enormous impact that echoed on for years. And such is the opportunity and responsibility for climate hawks, is to get out there, make their voices heard, drop that pebble into the pond of history and try and make it ripple, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did you read that? Did you like the article as much as I obviously did?
I love the article, and it reminded me of a number of different things. Number one, it reminded me of that line that was attributed to Naomi Klein, that to change everything, it takes everyone. It reminded me of that great line from Edmund Burke, that all that it takes for evil to prosper is for good people to do nothing. It reminded me of that old line, power concedes nothing without a demand.
And also I've never heard that one before.
And it also reminded me of a piece that ran in mid-March about, from the New York Times, about the new optimism of Al Gore, and how Gore, who for many years was concerned that there would not be, you know, sufficient and necessary public demand for action, is now encouraged that there is a growing climate movement to demand action and to demand change in the way we do energy. And I mentioned to a friend of mine that, you know, if this ultimately succeeds, and I think it will, then I think that we're going to be saying that you know, Gore really did win the 2000 election. It just took a few years to actually count the votes.
Well, on that note, DR, we'll have to end. Let me remind our listeners, who are the smartest and most involved people in the world. Let me tell you that you can check out most of the links to what we've talked about at our blog. It's a WordPress blog, massclimateaction.wordpress.com. You can leave a comment there, or you can send us an email, comment@massclimateaction.net. You can find this show on Facebook, and in fact, many of the links will be on our Facebook page. It's /massclimateaction. Please like the page, like the show, share the show with your friends so that more people can learn about us. You can listen to our show directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, or you can find us on iTunes. The easiest way is to go to the podcast and search for Massachusetts Climate Action, and we will pop right to the top of the list. If you subscribe there, it improves our visibility, and it lets others learn about our show. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. Thank you for being here, DR.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.